Yeah, well, one of the things that I should have said to speak more precisely is when I say random, what I meant was plausible IP addresses from within the network range that is on. You know, we can tell it, use this range, you know, pull plausible IPs from this range.
Let's just go and demo, then might help
some answers. Yeah, we can do that. You've got that fired up then? Okay.
There was a slide we can show you, something called a virtual NX, which is part of VMware, GSX. You have a Linux host operating system with another Linux operating system, XP operating system. So if you remember that diagram, go ahead and look at your slide in the diagram. Those yellow systems, the yellow honeypots, well, the window right here, this one right here, where you see here, that's a Linux honeypot. This is a Linux honeypot right there. It's a guy in yellow. We also have a XP box, Windows XP honeypot. And what these honeypots are doing are they're sitting behind that HoneyNet sensor, my Linux laptop. So what's going to happen now is Ed is going to SSH into the Linux honeypot. He's going to SCP a file. And what we're going to do is the HoneyNet sensor is going to passively capture his keystrokes and up that upload of the file. What you see in this slide here, right here, is right now the capturing packet being sent by the honeypot. Even when there's no one on the honeypot, it's sending packets. So the packet, it's not like a digest keystroke packet goes out. There's always packets going out every 3 seconds, however you set it. Even when the guy's not doing anything, you're sending coming traffic. But it's not the packet after your keystroke. They're sending in first, however. Set it up anyway. NTPs, NTP, DNS, CDP, IPX, whatever the kind of traffic's looking like. Yep. Once you go into SSH into the system. So what you're going to see now is you can SSH into the system, it's kind of hard to see. But you're going to all of a sudden see the snipper is going to be seeing the him going in. So he's SSHing his honeypot right now.
Yeah, I'm going to run a command that will hopefully generate a lot of data.
What's that?
I'm going to run something that should cause that to.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
No, notice he's on it. He's done a lot of.
Okay, there it goes, right there.
Now let's go ahead. You're seeing packets hit the wire. Our snippers capturing that. I said, go ahead and SCP a file.
Okay.
You're going to go ahead and SCP the file to a honeypot. Meanwhile, from the network, we're going ahead and snipping it. And if I go ahead and I fire up snort, snort minus V dash I VM net 1.
Okay. The file's copied. Okay.
Boom. There you see it all going stuff like that. And look, what you're seeing is port 139 traffic because we got it looking like NetBIOS. So what he's done now is he's gone ahead and transferred that information, and we passively picked it off the wire. What we're going to do right now is just show you, how that information would look. So we're in it right there. You look in the 192.168. I'm going to highlight that in. White right there, that's the log file. That's the log file. Then Ed's created something called SPDump.
SPDump, yeah.
And that C is 192.168.1.101. Boom, we got all those keystrokes right there. And then what we can do here, from the test, if you want the actual any files you uploaded, what is it, S?
S for any SCP files out of the log.
S. Boom. All right, it just extracted the GIF file. So he uploaded the GIF file.
So I hope we need to render the GIF.
We're going to be demoing this at our booth all the way today, too. So if you have any questions, you want specifics, come to you can see it.
Yeah. We got one we got one question here.
Go ahead.
We could do it for every, but you get a lot of volume. So it's and as we go along, I've still haven't got it nailed down to all we want yet, but it's an evolutionary process. So, but yeah, we do a subset right now.
All right, what we're gonna do now is shift gears and keep moving. If you're interested more in the details of the Gen 2 data control or the data capture, come on to our booth. We'd be more than happy to demo. Ed can show you all sorts of fun stuff. Like I said, we are running this on virtual NX. You can run it on UML, you can go with Linux. So I actually have the entire running on my laptop. Mm-hmm. And then also, real quick, why don't you talk about your wireless running in DC? I don't think there's any slides.
In the past month, I've deployed a in its infancy, a wireless honey net in the DC area, consisting of about 5 access points, covering about, I would say, about 5 city blocks locally in the DC area. We have very similar technology doing the data capture and data control. Two things about what we're looking for on the network is that with wireless in general, we're not going to be seeing any like new exploits attacking like a Red Hat 6.2 box. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking at how people are currently exploiting wireless honey nets in general. How many are out there doing it? Is this a widespread problem as you might think? Well, for anyone who's currently connected to the network in here, you should already be quite concerned about how your packets are being snipped right now, is because I've seen some people in here snipping up pop email passwords out just by, you know, sitting in here while you're in here. So that's one of the things we're looking at. We're looking at gathering statistics about how often someone is just driving by and accidentally either picks up your access points and attaches to your network, or is it malicious? Is this accidental? Once they attach to their network, are they looking for free internet? Are they looking for other machines on your network? Are they starting to push the envelope? Since we've been up, I have seen most people try to reach the internet. The HoneyNet in general right now does not have an internet connection. That is a decision that we're still wrestling with, because as soon as we connect it to the internet, we're essentially granting free internet access to anyone who attaches to the internet in the DC area. So there's some concerns about that, obviously, with the data control side. You know, if someone attaches the network and they just go straight out and starts pounding on someone, how do we throttle that down? So I'm looking into some of the NoCat auth capture portal technology to help us out there. There's a lot of guys around there, a lot smarter on the wireless stuff. Mike Schiffman had an excellent talk the other day about wireless that I sat in on. So I'm starting incorporating some of these technologies into the HoneyNet in general. Some of the things I have been finding, I've noticed that there's about 2 or 3 DHCP addresses handed out per day on the network. What these addresses are doing right now, it seems to me nothing. Either they're just driving by, or just someone in the local 5-block radius turns on their XP computer and accidentally attaches to it, but they don't surf out to the internet, or they don't. We don't see any of those packets. We have seen one ping sweep go through that just pinged off for the computers. I'm not sure if it's an automated tool or if it was a prelude to a malicious intent, but that is some of the things that we're slowly researching at this point. Question? I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Yes, I have very turning off the DHCP server on and off. I have seen a lot of just random packets because it's a 192.168 network. You see a lot of the internal networks with that. We have picked up packets maybe not directly intended for the network that we're sitting on. But as soon as I turn DHCP back on, I notice that there's more statistics that are generated for that specifically. And one of the things I am looking at is if it's malicious or non-malicious intent, if it's just a casual user versus someone out there looking for free internet. Nova Wireless is probably out there looking right now, because Security Focus just did an article on it. And I've been on RFMON, which is a Nova Wireless net, and they've been started talking about going out and hunting this little honey net down, trying to find it so they could get free internet access. So those are some of the things. We're still in the infancy. I'm still learning a lot. I have a very small crew working on this, and we're looking at how to increase logging mechanisms on wireless networks in general. To do that, it is very difficult to log anything on a wireless network. Just by default, anyone could anonymously attach to the network and do whatever they want. You sit outside of Starbucks or Apple Store, you know what I'm talking about, or even in here, except unless you're being sniffed and you're using encryption. So I'm going to go ahead and press on this. If you have any other questions, I'll be out at the booth outside as well. Just come up and hunt me down and fire away.
Like I said, this is going to be fast and furious. How is all this legal? I don't know. Ask him.
I'm Richard Salgado from the Department of Justice Computer Crime Section. One of the things I do for the section is pay attention to honeypots and take a look at the legal angle at it. And then the other thing I do, of course, is try to convict Brian Martin in conferences. This is my contact information. Really, I'm only allowed to be giving legal advice to the to government entities out there. So if you are involved in government work or you are an individual who works for one of the agencies, feel free to contact me, and I'll be able to give you a little more specific advice. The point I want to make today about the legal side of honeypots is really simple. Consult legal counsel before you put something up. And that's it, and I can sit down, but I'll probably elaborate a little bit on that. It is untested. We haven't seen prosecutions. We haven't seen civil suits involving honeypots. But there's, you know, there's sort of a general feeling, I think, among you folks and among HoneyNet and some other folks who've been out there with playing with the idea of honeypots, that there may be something different here with regard to honeypots than regular production servers. There's just things seem like this is slightly different, and maybe the legal rules regarding honeypots are a little bit different as well. And I'm going to talk about the possibility that that is the case and some of the areas that we see as being potentially implicated by honeypots that might not otherwise present such a problem. The three main things I'm going to talk about, one, the Federal Wiretap Act, which is a statute that prohibits, it can make it a felony to intercept electronic communications while they're transiting through the network. The second I'm going to talk about is some potential civil liability issues that may be heightened when you're talking about a honeypot as opposed to a regular production server. The third thing I'm going to talk about is something known as entrapment. And there's always sort of, I sense a queasy feeling on the part of people who are putting up honeypots about, well, is this really right? Am I inducing somebody to do something they shouldn't be doing? And am I going to get in trouble for that? And hopefully I'll be able to shed some light on that. But these really are things I'm going to talk about to highlight for you to be able to go to your counsel and say, these are some things I'm worried about, and you get your advice from them, because I am most certainly not your attorney, nor am I these guys' attorney. All right. See, I say that way I get to keep my license to practice law and my job. The Wiretap Act. The Wiretap Act is a federal statute. I'm sorry? I'm not up to date on my slides?
No.
Oh, okay. I'm not going to talk off those in there.
No,
these are
in
mine.
The book. Richard, do you have slides you
want? No. There's really three points. You can, I'm sure, do the, keep track of this without slides up there. Wiretap Act. It prohibits the interception of electronic communications and can be a felony. There can be civil liabilities as a result of doing it. It's a general prohibition, and it often catches system administrators and security folks by surprise a little bit to know that it really can be a problem if you're watching traffic on your network. So there's this general prohibition, you can't do it. Thankfully, Congress gave us a lot of exceptions to the Wiretap Act so that folks who are in certain situations are allowed to watch the traffic on their network. Well, with honeypots, that's exactly what you're doing, right? The whole point is to see what's going on in the network and in fact, see everything that's going on in the network. There are three exceptions to the Wiretap Act that potentially apply to make it legitimate and legal under the Wiretap Act to watch the intruders that are coming in. Now, this kind of surprises people because they think, well, these are hackers. These are people who are attacking my machine. Do they really have this sort of right of privacy to what they're doing? And the answer is, well, Congress passed this act that does generally give people the right of privacy in their electronic communications, even if they're unauthorized. There's nothing in the statute that says it only applies to people who are authorized to be on your system. So we do start off with that premise that this could be illegal. So then we start looking to the exceptions. The first exception to the prohibition against watching traffic on your network is if you're doing it to protect your system. You're watching the traffic because you're trying to protect your system from hostile attack, from criminal activity, from somebody stealing the information or looking at information, getting the privacy implications of somebody on your system. If that's your motive and you're authorized to be watching the traffic in your organizational structure, then under the Wiretap Act, it's okay to be watching those communications. It's an uneasy fit for honeypots, though, isn't it? Because this is an exception to protect your system. Well, why are you putting the system out there? To be attacked. So you're watching the attackers in order to protect the system that you put out there in order to be attacked. So it's a very odd fit, and we haven't seen it play out in a court. I don't know what a court would say to that. But it seems odd to be saying, you know, I'm trying to protect it, but I'm really kind of wanting people.
Right.
That would be the argument. The question here is, well, and I'm going to rephrase it and tell me if I got it wrong, but we are trying to protect our system in a more of a macro way. I've got this honeypot out here so I can learn of zero day, I can learn of these vulnerabilities that I may actually have on a production server, and by learning those things, I can tighten up my production server. And therefore, by watching these communications, I am in fact trying to protect my production server over here. That is an argument you might be able to make. And I think the argument gets stronger the closer your honeypot actually gets to your production server. So if your honeypot is actually picking up certain siphoned off type of suspicious traffic that otherwise we would be headed to your production server, you have a better argument to say, well, it actually is there next to my production server trying to protect it. Therefore, I'm properly employing this exception to the Wiretap Act. If it's just out there all by itself and you don't see a production server near it, it's a little weaker argument, but maybe it flies. You're saying, well, I'm just generally trying to increase my knowledge of security, which is going to protect my production servers 10 years from now. I don't know if a court's going to buy that, but there's some squishiness here. I think that's true. Yeah. The disclosure of the interceptions. If the question is about the sharing of the information, even if it's acquired legitimately under the Wiretap Act, if it has been legitimately acquired by under the Wiretap Act's exception for the provider protection exception, you can disclose it. There was no violation of the Act, and there's no problem with disclosing that. The second exception. If that doesn't work, there's another exception that might work, and that is the consent of the party or one of the parties to the communication, right? So that sort of makes sense. You can, if you're on the telephone, you can give consent to somebody else listening in on the telephone under the Federal Wiretap Act, and there's no problem there with them listening in. Same thing with electronic communications. If one of the parties to the communication says it's okay to intercept the traffic, it's okay. Well, who are the parties to that communication? You're going to have your attacker. It's possible to get the consent of the attacker through banners, right? So if you've got a bannered honeypot that says, by using this system, you're consenting to our intercepting or you're being monitored, there's consent. So that's one way to get consent. Yes, sir. Yeah, state law can be different. Some state laws have what's known as dual consent or all-party consent, which means you can't intercept communication unless everybody on the system or who are involved in that communication has consented to that. So then you got to make sure that everybody, like if you're trying to keep track of a chat, everybody has consented to your keeping track of that chat. So what I'm talking about right now really is just federal. And on the federal side, one-party consent. If you're going to set your honeypot up in a particular state, you're going to want to make sure your council checks into the Wiretap Act's laws for that particular state. The question is, well, what about the computer that is the honeypot? Isn't it a party to the communication? Ah, that's a good point. Maybe it is, right? Somebody's connecting to my computer to store files on it. You've got one party, the person's trying to send the files. Who's the other party to this communication? Maybe it's the computer, it's the honeypot, and you can get consent from the operator or owner of the honeypot to do the intercept. That probably works, and there's some case law that talks about that. Now, it gets trickier if you're just being used as a pass-through, right? Hitting, coming in, laundering IP address, and going out again. Are you a part of that communication, or are you just the telephone switch operator that, you know, helping plug through the connection? Then it gets a little trickier to rely on the system owner. The question is, if the attacker is in a state law where the law is different than where the honeypot is, am I aware of a case where the state authorities have tried to assert jurisdiction and say that even though you intercepted it in a different state, our laws applied and you violated our laws? I do not know of such an action. Most of the statutes actually, the place of the interception determines what law applies. I'm sorry, what's your same answer? It's going to be the point of interception typically decides which. But we don't, in the United States, we can't, for example, enforce our wiretap act for an interception that's happening in Canada. So that's right. Yes, sir. Say it again. A log file that's keeping track of communications in general would be an interception of communications, arguably, and thus you're going to need an exception to the Wiretap Act to do so. Usually system protection exception or consent would be the system administrator's basis for doing that. I'm running a little short on time here. I guess I'll hang out at their booth, as bad as that is for my reputation. The third exception that applies at times is what's known as the computer trespasser exception. This is an exception that applies, typically where this really applies is where somebody has intruded into your system and they're not authorized to be there. And in some situations, the system administrator, where this happens, this is sort of outside the honeypot context, doesn't have the means to do the monitoring and would say, government, will you please come in and monitor this intruder? Government can come in and monitor that intruder, and there's no violation of the Wiretap Act so long as the person coming in is unauthorized. This can apply, we think, to honeypots, where everybody coming in would be unauthorized, and thus if you had government doing the monitoring, or if government, it was a government honeypot, there would be an exception to the Wiretap Act. All right. The third topic I wanted to talk about was civil liability. Think about what happens when you put this machine up and the possibility that it's used as a platform to attack other machines. A plaintiff's lawyer for a downstream victim of your honeypot, somebody who's gotten into your honeypot and attacked, may want to argue in a civil court, look, this guy put this honeypot up here knowing it was going to get broken into, hoping it was going to get broken into, intending it was going to get broken into, and then it was, no big surprise, and used to attack me. They should be held liable for having that happen. So it may be that there's a heightened level of potential for civil liability in the honeypot context than there isn't in a production server context. I don't know if that's true or not. I can just see this play out. Okay. That he had a vulnerable machine too, so it's sort of. All right. One of the other problems is, what if your site is used to store contraband? You suddenly start finding a WARES site pop up. You find stolen credit cards. You find child pornography. Bad situation. It takes a lot of time to monitor what's really going on your box. And you take that a step further. What if you start finding, okay, now your honeypot's being used to distribute these items? So you got to be careful to watch what is happening. And not just because you might get in legal trouble for that. You might. But also because it just, you know, as a matter of public relations, especially if your honeypot's associated with an enterprise, that's an awful price to have to pay as well. My final point I wanted to hit briefly was this concept of entrapment. Because people a lot say, well, are honeypots right because you're entrapping people into hacking? Let me just tell you, entrapment really is a very, very narrow legal doctrine that applies in criminal cases as a defense for defendants. What defendants will argue at times is, I would not have committed the crime had government not induced me to do so. Right? I was not going to commit the crime unless government caused me to commit the crime. It's a pretty narrow defense, and it's only one that you assert in a criminal proceeding to get off of the charges. So for private entities who are running their own honeypots, entrapment really, in that sense, doesn't make any sense. A private entity can induce somebody to commit a crime without it being entrapment for later prosecution. Now, for a government honeypot, it's conceivable that there would be an entrapment issue, although it's such a difficult defense to prove, especially in the context of hacking, that we haven't seen anything close to that.
What we can do, too, is if you have slides, we'll put them on the HoneyNet
slide. Okay, yeah, we can supplement the HoneyNet slide with the slides I've got here that didn't make it into the presentation. Yes, sir. Right. I mean, if you just stick your honeypot out there, it's hard to see where the entrapment is. If you put your honeypot out there and then take all sorts of active measures to try to attract a particular person to it, to the point of inducing it, that's when maybe, I think it's still unlikely, but maybe that's where the thought of entrapment would come in. But it's probably not an issue for most private honeypots. We need to move on, but thank you. I'm happy to talk to you after this.
He'll be around. We did this reverses challenge. Essentially, I'm going to go through here pretty quick. I got a bunch of things. We've got the binary that we released. It was found on a HoneyNet. It's a remote backdoor. It uses network encoding. It's not cryptographically secure. What it essentially is, the DDoS agent does a lot of stuff like that and a backdoor. It was statically linked. That proved to be a moderate, inconvenience for reverse engineering the functionality of this thing, but... Yeah. Really. Challenge background. It was judged by a panel. Dave Dietrich, Joe Behas, myself, Alvar, Hera, and Niles Provost. Niels. We essentially got this binary, put it out on the net, invited security professionals or whomever under the sun to analyze it, attempt to understand the functionality and everything else like that. These are the questions we put forward. Essentially, what is this thing? What does it do? Why is it functioning in various manners? Can you identify, any special components within it? Just essentially to gain an understanding of the tools, methods, techniques, which ways got you the best sort of mileage in terms of reverse engineering, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that. Here's some of the network traffic that we also sent out. As you can see here, it's some data. You can pretty much guess it's encoded. This is encoded data that was sent here. Some people even wrote like snort decoders or post processors, which would decode all of this on the fly and then match it to signatures. But as you know, it's pretty clear that it's not cryptographically secure. You can see there's obviously some nulls here that generated this obvious pattern. And that's another thing about HoneyNets. We've got this data, and it's very easy to analyze, and people can actually look at it. By and large, we've got just a few packets every now and then in comparison to lots of traffic. Here's the decode via that snort plugin or post processor or what have you. Here again, the lessons learned. We wanted to understand the thought process, what was the most economical way of doing things. What possible misdirections are found when you're analyzing binaries, things like that. I calculated these up. I essentially took the most senior challenger, if there were multiple people in the group who challenged, and summed up the total time it took them to do things and their experience. A lot of man hours were spent. Someone was telling me that this is, they figured they could just do this as a denial of service on the security community, like put out just funny things, lots of people spinning their cycles, So the most successful challengers used static and active analysis. If you do a static analysis, via not running the binary and just looking at the bytes, you're going to have a fairly good idea of what's going on, highly detailed and whatnot. It's a lot more time consuming though, and you can augment that with an active analysis to sort of pinpoint critical sections of the binary and then kind of work inside out. A lot of people kind of were static and then went to active and they never went back. That kind of for speed, for time's sake, they only had a month to do this. But, I think both of these techniques should be used fairly in conjunction. There's a lot of tools. I know people like to hear about tools and websites and URLs and stuff. Michael Zielinski's got this webpage for Finneris for other, and it's got a huge list of reverse engineering tools and stuff. Standard console utilities were used quite a bit. I'll just burn through here. Active analysis, UML, some people tried to use that. It's deadly easy to escape a UML, though. I wouldn't recommend using a UML for anything other than just testing configs and, when you're not dealing in a hostile environment, essentially. Standard debuggers, some of these things, the double fork kind of freak people out. Most people just would skip over that section or knock those calls out or something. a lot of tracing utils, the alphabet soup trace, systrace, truss, whatnot. Fenris was good. It's got this utility dress. Again, it was a statically linked binary, so it was convenient to remap the symbols from that those libraries to the binary so that you could identify the actual code of the binary and not waste time playing around in, you know, shared libraries. Here are a number of other tools that people used. Reverse engineers compiler, that's kind of interesting. It's been around forever, but the names are somewhat meaningless, and it's just takes this C, assembly converts it to C, but it doesn't have much to go on in terms of symbols, so it's kind of not the easiest thing to understand. Various, Perl scripts and things like that. Commercially supported tools, I was going to try and show a little bit of IDA stuff, but might not be able to do that. Graphing is really convenient. If you graph it, I was going to show that too, that you can really easily identify the core processing loops and see precisely the sections that you would want to reverse engineer and understand, essentially. VMware is really interesting. Some people use Source Insight, kind of source browser to download, download the source for libc and then sort of map the source to the binary. It's kind of interesting, kind of time consuming. Post-processor, client applications, people kind of, as they went along to test their theories, would develop tools to interact with this daemon as it ran. Also, there were various techniques to rebuild the libc symbols, like Unstrip, Challenger 32, essentially made this tool. It's pretty interesting. It's kind of like Dress for Fenris, but it's standalone. I think we're releasing all of these things so everyone can take a look at all the analyses and whatnot. Yeah, it's all online. It would go through and attempt to, he went and downloaded the binary libc's from all kinds of distributions, and whoever had the most matches in terms of the signature would win in terms of the most, closest libc to the one that was statically linked in there. There were very few discrepancies when he was pretty precise with his analysis. Again, static, we don't actually run the binary. It's difficult to trace in complex applications, so that was a bit of a drag. In certain circumstances. And then you've got all of these compiler wrappers for syscalls, where it's a couple of functions deep. So, you don't want to waste time figuring out, oh, this is just the setup code for set socket or, sig action or what have you, sig whatever. Active, the code may be destructive, so you got to look out for that. That, might be handy to do a little static analysis and look for, troubling things like, a lot of people marked that, they had a percent S, or SH-C percent S, so they knew that there was some kind of command execution going to happen arbitrarily, and they, didn't want it to RM their whole system. Again, you can quickly identify important sections of the application, so you run it and you get to a critical processing loop, and then you can start and go inside out, sort of just ignore everything else and just hope that that wasn't important. If you're really in a pinch for time, I think one guy did this in like 11 hours or something stupid like that. So that's one way he went through there. Theoretically, if you do that though, also the code path can be accurately identified. So you don't waste time in obfuscated code or, anti-reversing, anti-debugging tricks, or obfuscations. Not many people did a pure static. That really isn't the best way to go about things, I don't think. You spend a lot of time. You got to be real pro, really, to go through that. Again, the fastest time, leveraging a combination of both. Many people reconstructed the C binary. Now, that really, as you go along, helps you solidify your assumptions. And it was really interesting to see some people reproduced the C code so precisely that it was better than the original. It was really interesting. They have to go back there and reread this. And there were actually bugs. It was interesting. There were bugs that were in the binary and bugs that were in the C code that were generated, but some people actually didn't spot the bugs. So you've got to kind of go back and analyze everything that you've got, every little bit of information, more and more. Eliminate static code. That wasn't really a big deal. And the network decoder was extremely poorly written. One thing that kind of helped out was that there was a decode and an encode function in there. and they were inverse of each other. And I think the encode, or was it the decode? One or the other was coded a lot more simplistic, and that sort of gave people hints at, you know, what was really going on. The encoder was just going all over the place, and it was tough to identify exactly what it was doing. Strings analysis, you know, that will get you strings. You know, that might not help all the time. Fingerprint analysis, you know, fingerprinting is good, but, you know, again, obfuscations might thwart that. Algorithm identification, from being able to identify magic numbers, random number generators. If you can see, like, DES, like, encryption blocks in there, you know, then that might tell you what's going on with that. You know, syscall identification, that's pretty easy, although it's trivial to thwart. You know, in essence here, we're going to jump over this fake move here and trick out a lot of the Ubru tools. You can even fool IDA. We can get around. This isn't exactly set SID. That's actually, what was that? Syscall 2. That move 42 never actually executes, but IDA thinks it does. So you've got to look out for tools. And, you know, if this was a really advanced guy, he would have defeated a number of analyses that were done. Black box testing, you know, you get a section of code, you put it in a, you just take it straight out of the binary, you know, fix up its input and output, and that'll help you sort of identify what's going on. Graphical analysis, it's really cool. Active analysis. The binary had a number of bugs in it. You know, hopefully your IP address didn't have a null in it or else it wouldn't work. So this guy was obviously really, really on the low end of application development. Overview, okay. Eliminate the static link code. You know, people use a lot of different tools and techniques. Profile, S-tracing, whatnot. Future, burn-eye, that's a real hassle to deal with in certain circumstances. If you don't have the passphrase, I mean, you're going to crack, what does it use, some kind of encryption that's good or something. There were no real other obfuscations, anti-debugging, reversing, you know, none of that was going on. This is me. I want to show just really quick a couple of things in IDA, which are, here, this is like the original binary. It doesn't really, you know, you can't really see. There's a number of calls here. Oh, what's this do? Okay, well, I have to go in. Oh, that's fork, you know, and then come back. And then a number of these other ones are just wrappers for those same syscalls, but you have to go pretty far to figure out what's going on. The graphical analysis, oh, right here. Here's a core processing loop. So you come in and you just go boom, boom, boom. Oh, what's this? And go in on it a little more. And then here's the signature analysis, too. Like, you can apply a signature, and then really, apparently, you get all the symbols, and that's really, really fun. Okay. Well, this one, the guy made it himself by using Flare and whatnot, so you might have to learn how to use some automated functionality in IDA.
We're going to wrap things up here real quick. If you want some more stuff on this, we're hoping to have more time for K2, but we did. K2 will be hanging out at the booth, so if you want more forensics. We actually had top 20 winners. They all got prizes. If you want to see the top 20 winners, just a real quick funny story. The seventh place winner, his name is Change. The original seventh place winner, we found out, was the guy that actually hacked us and actually coded the binary. How we found that out was the Australian police. The Australian contacted us, and they contacted, oh, by the way, your seventh place winner is under arrest and in jail. But I think it was Kate that brought up the good point. If he wrote the damn binary, he only got seventh place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't demonstrate the, you know, the objectives were to show analysis techniques and everything else, and he just shortcutted a lot of that.
Yeah, so we have a lot of stuff. It was a fast and furious. If you want more, meet us at the booth.